Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Bring the world closer with podcasts from the BBC World Service. Unmissable stories from around the globe.
Whoa.
Search for the documentary Lives Less Ordinary and Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You better be ready, because we're going to bring it to you.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Danny Cox, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 27th of December, these are our main stories. Israel's military chief has said the war in Gaza will continue for months until it's reached the top leaders of Hamas. Serbia's main opposition coalition says demonstrators arrested during protests against the result of disputed elections could face charges. Argentina's new president has announced that 7,000 public sector jobs will be cut by the end of the week as he tries to tackle inflation. Also in this podcast,
decisions we make over AI in 2024 will be pivotal and will have significant impact on all of our tomorrows.
AI tells us why it's set to go mainstream next year. The head of the Israeli army has warned that the war in Gaza will go on for months after launching more than 100 airstrikes in 24 hours, including areas it previously said were safe. Israel said it was increasing its military pressure. UN officials say around 100 Palestinians have been killed since Christmas Eve. The Hamas-run health ministry in Gaza says almost 21,000 Palestinians have now been killed since the war began in October. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has again vowed there'll be no peace until Hamas is destroyed. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Shama Khalil, sent this report.
There's been no let-up in the bombardment of southern Gaza, both in Khan Yunis and Rafah, two areas where more than 1 million people have fled from the north. Video footage shows the destruction of family homes, with children sifting through the rubble to find their toys and books. One small girl, Amal, was at home with her family in Khan Yunis when the bombs landed.
We were sleeping, then I heard a big bang. She said, rocks have landed on us. Our windows were broken.
And there is no prospect of the situation easing for the people suffering in Gaza or for the families of the hostages taken by Hamas, who continue their protests outside government buildings in Tel Aviv. The war in Gaza is not close to being over, is the message from the government. A view echoed by the head of the Israeli army.
This war has necessary goals that are not so easily achievable. It's happening in a complicated field. Therefore, the war will continue for more months, and we will use different methods so that what we've achieved will be maintained over time.
Whether it was a week or months, the IDF would reach the Hamas leadership, he concluded.
Shama Khalil. In a separate development, police in Delhi say they're investigating an explosion near the Israeli embassy in the Indian capital on Tuesday. Israeli and Indian media reports say a letter addressed to the Israeli ambassador in India was found near the site of the blast, but its contents were not disclosed. Israel's deputy head of mission in Delhi said all the embassy staff were safe and Israeli security teams were working with local police. The Palestinian president Mahmoud Abbas has been speaking to Egyptian television about the war in Gaza. In a rare interview, he accused the United States of failing Palestinians in the territory by continuing to support Israel. Mr. Abbas leads the Fatah political party in the occupied West Bank, a rival to Hamas. Our Cairo correspondent Sally Nabil listened to the Egyptian TV interview.
He used really strong words in describing what's happening in Gaza. He said it's far more than a disaster and far beyond a genocide. He said that the Palestinians have never seen something like that before. It's even worse than the Nakba, referring to the year of 1948 when Israel was founded. He said that more than 20,000 people have been killed in Gaza, but there are between 7,000 and 10,000 still buried under the rubble and no one knows anything about them. He blamed the U.S. big time here because he referred to the veto the U.S. has used in the U.N. Security Council lately that has disrupted a resolution, a U.N. resolution calling for a ceasefire. And he clearly said if the U.S. wants the assault to stop, it will stop because it's the only country that can pressure Israel to do so. But apparently what's going on is supported by Washington. That's his words. And he also said that Mr. Netanyahu's government is aiming to wipe out the Palestinian existence, not just in Gaza, but also in the West Bank and Jerusalem. And he referred to recurrent Israeli attacks against the Palestinians in the West Bank and Jerusalem. And he said that the ultimate goal is to push the people of Gaza into the Egyptian Sinai Peninsula. And a lot of reports have been actually talking about that, that the constant bombardment might push Palestinian families to walk into the Sinai Peninsula. But again, he thanked the Egyptians for not allowing this to happen because the Egyptians have been very reluctant to open the borders for the residents of Gaza to stay permanently in Sinai because that, according to Egyptian statements, will undermine the Palestinian cause. He said that he finds that the Israeli argument about the right to self-defense is illogical, and he doesn't believe that Israel is still keen on having the two-state solution. It just wants to wipe out the Palestinian existence. And what's more important here is that he said that the Palestinian Authority is ready to run Gaza, and it has enough staff and enough people to run Gaza. But that's a very controversial issue, given the huge lack of trust between Hamas that controls Gaza and the Palestinian Authority on one hand. Besides, the Israelis have not accepted the fact that the Palestinian authorities and Mr. Abbas can run Gaza, given perhaps the lack of trust between members of the Palestinian Authority and the residents of Gaza.
Sally Nabil. Next to Serbia, anti-government protesters were again out on the streets of the capital Belgrade on Tuesday over the disputed result of elections earlier this month. The country's largest opposition coalition, Serbia Against Violence, says the authorities are planning to charge people who took part in protests on Sunday. Dozens of people were arrested after some of the crowd smashed windows at City Hall. Guy Delaunay reports.
A lawyer connected to the opposition said those arrested faced charges of calling for the violent overthrow of the constitutional order. It follows violent scenes at Belgrade City Hall on Sunday. Police detained almost 40 people at the time, and there have since been further arrests. Opposition leaders accused the authorities of politically motivated persecution. There's been no official confirmation of any charges, but Belgrade's chief police officer has publicly accused opposition activists of attempting to force their way into City Hall. Protests calling for the annulment of the election for the city assembly are still being held every evening. The opposition accused the government of busing in tens of thousands of people to influence the vote.
Guy Delaunay. As we heard in the earlier podcast, the Russian dissident Alexei Navalny has told supporters not to worry about him, insisting he's relieved to have reached the Serbian penal colony where he's being transferred. Mr. Navalny had temporarily disappeared from public view, but was located by his lawyer on Monday, newly incarcerated at the site known as Polar Wolf. It's now emerged that he was taken hundreds of miles by train as the only passenger on a zigzag journey, ending up in the remote prison. Paddy O'Connell spoke to Mr. Navalny's chief of staff, Leonid Volkov, who said that the opposition leader had effectively become the personal prisoner of the Russian president Vladimir Putin ahead of an election year in which everyone knows he will triumph.
He was surprised that we were able to locate him so quickly, because when he arrived in Kharkiv on Saturday, it was clear to him what was their plan. So according to the laws, if you arrive to a new colony, you are allowed to notify your lawyers and relatives within 10 days. But on January 1st, Russia goes on vacation, like nothing works for 10 days. So as he was put there on December 23rd, his legal ability to notify anyone could be postponed before like January 2nd. So we were not be able to locate him until mid-January, and that was the original plan. But because of the tremendous work that our lawyers did, like sending more than 600 requests to different penal colonies and prison camps We were able to guess that most probably he'll be there in Harp. And Monday morning, December 3rd, 25th, the first working day after he's been put there, our lawyer came to that colony and was able to locate him there and was able to reestablish contact with him.
I'm reading on the wires agencies that this colony was founded in the 1960s as what we in the West knew was called the Gulag system of forced Soviet labor camps. He seems to be trying to send a morale-boosting message. Whatever he says, how worried about him are you?
Well, we are worried. We don't forget for a second that he is in custody of that very people who tried to kill him 3.5 years ago, and that he is Putin's very personal political prisoner. And this journey, this forced journey with many stopovers he made in the last 20 days is yet another proof. So, of course, we are very worried. And, well, the only protection, if any, that still exists for Alexei Navalny is the spotlight of publicity. Mm. Putin has to be reminded that the world cares about Navalny and that he can't just, like, hide him or kill him or whatever. This is very important for us.
And he himself has said, I am your new Father Frost. I now have a sheepskin coat. He is, in a way, saying things that will be read by Vladimir Putin. We can be sure Vladimir Putin's following his movements. But can we also be pretty sure that meaningful opposition in Russia is dead?
No, that's not true. We are the meaningful opposition in Russia. I mean, we operate from our office in Vilnius, but we have tens of thousands of volunteers and activists within the country who put anti-war leaflets and graffitis and who run an advocacy campaign against Putin and against the war. We employ also hundreds or even thousands of Russians who left the country to make calls inside the country anti-Putin and anti-war. So the opposition movement is strong because, as the latest polls show, now 3/4 of Russian population strongly and clearly opposes the war.
Alexei Navalny's chief of staff, Leonid Volkov. Now, meet Ada, a humanoid robot with an AI brain.
I'm Ada, the world's first ultra-realistic robot artist. I'm sending you best wishes for a happy new year filled with creativity and meaningful connection. As we welcome in a new year, I hope you will join me and look into the future of humanity. Decisions we make over AI in 2024 will be pivotal and will have significant impact on all of our tomorrows.
As she says, Ada was the world's first ultra-realistic artist robot launched back in 2019 and has contributed to various art exhibitions, including alongside human artists. Created by British researchers, she's based on the ideas of Aidan Miller, an art historian and director of the Ada Robot Project. He's been speaking to the BBC's Nick Robinson on some seismic changes we can expect from artificial intelligence.
AI is incredibly powerful. It's going to transform society as we know it. And I think we're really only at the very beginning. We're having these explosions of developments, things like ChatGPT that people know about. But in actual fact, as more and more people get to grips with it, we think that by 2026, 2027, there's going to be a seismic change as AI is in all industries.
We hear words like seismic and transform. Give us a sense. I know there's a new version of ChatGPT coming out. If you're an ordinary punter, how might it change your life?
Well, it's not so much whether you grab hold of it or not. It's the fact that it's using you, the fact that it's on your phone, that it's collecting data. The algorithms are harvesting that data so that it will be able to interact with you in a more accurate way. And next year is a very big year for AI. We have indeed got ChatGPT-5 coming out. Suddenly, rather than just doing it as a text-based editor, it will actually then start to do action. So you could say to your phone, could you book me the restaurant on Monday at 7? ChatGPT-5 will be able to phone up the restaurant, speak to them audibly, book it for you, and then come back to you and say, yeah, we've now done that. You've now got the booking. Can you imagine how that's going to be useful in business, etc.? It's very powerful just on that one technology. But the most significant thing for next year is actually the arrival, finally, of the metaverse.
What Mark Zuckerberg's been talking about for so long.
It has been long in the making, and in light of some of the difficulties they've had to try and make it sure it's safe and do all the things that it needs to do.
Safe, important word. We've heard so often this year about how AI might be unsafe. Now, you're not, we should stress, are you, a computer scientist? You came to this via art. What conclusion have you reached?
Art is benign. It's not going to threaten anybody, but we can actually tackle very tricky issues. So art is an incredible channel in which we go and discuss some of these issues. And something like the metaverse, it's going to be incredible in respect that you'll be able to have these new worlds. And actually, it's the world that we worry about. I think AI is going to enable us to have very fake situations, and we're not going to know whether they're fake or not. So in actual fact, it is a very serious matter.
You sound, though, still optimistic.
I think I do believe in the side of us. We are all hobbits that want to do it well, but we are always worried and tempted by doing it for harm. And I just hope that this technology, people will get an ethical consideration. And Ada's artwork is just basically exploring that so that we can make some very sensible decisions.
Aidan Muller, director of the Ada Robot Project, a glimpse there into the future. Still to come.
I welcome you to the Fellowship of Scholars.
We hear about the prisoners starting 2024 as university graduates.
Do you ever pass someone in the street and wonder, what's their story?
I was a very traumatized kid. Everything was about wanting to belong.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast where people share their experiences.
We beat the racist back.
Their dreams.
I wanted to see, what would a shot-for-shot remake of Raiders of the Lost Ark with kids look like?
And their secrets.
I was almost a school shooter.
Unmissable stories from around the globe. Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. 2024 is set to be the biggest election year in history, with more than half the world's population eligible to head to the polls. National elections are due to take place in more than 70 countries, although not all would meet the test of being free and fair. India describes itself as the world's largest democracy. The Prime Minister Narendra Modi's re-election next year seems more likely than not. But what does it mean for the future of India's democratic institutions? Our South Asia correspondent Samira Hussain sent this report.
Almost a decade in power, and India's Prime Minister's popularity has not diminished. Earlier this month, there were elections in five states, the last set of polling before the general election next year. Prime Minister Narendra Modi's BJP party may have lost Telangana in the south and Mizoram in the northeast, but it pulled off a hat trick, handedly winning Rajasthan, Madhya Pradesh and Chhattisgarh.
I was surprised at the sweep. I was also surprised that the BJP won all the three states in the Hindi heartland.
Nirja Chaudhary is a contributing editor to the Indian Express, a leading English language daily newspaper.
I think it means that it is almost a done deal for the BJP that's led by Narendra Modi, because it seems that at the end of 10 years, his popularity remains undimmed.
The way people vote in state elections does not always mirror what will happen federally, but history has shown that the BJP can lose regional elections and still win general elections decisively. The party's success largely lies in its charismatic leader and its nationalist agenda, promoting Hinduism as part of the country's national identity. But India also lacks a political party that can counter Mr. Modi's might.
Rahul Gandhi Jindabad!
Congress is the main opposition party, led by Rahul Gandhi. It ruled India for more than half a century, but it hasn't been able to recover from its 2014 electoral defeat. On the campaign trail, Gandhi says that he is the kind of leader that will fight for the poor, farmers, and day laborers. It presents itself as a party for all Indians. But Congress hasn't been able to deliver a clear message to voters on what the party stands for.
The opposition needs to get its narrative right, a narrative that appeals to people. Mr. Modi commands the trust of the electorate. People said he will somehow manage to run India, rule India. Now, that is not a sense of confidence they have about the opposition. So I think they need to go back to the drawing board and face these questions squarely. How do they counter the leadership of Mr. Modi?
But under the Modi government, there has been an erosion of democratic institutions. Human rights groups say violations have increased and press freedoms have diminished. It's an alarming path for the world's largest democracy. But Mr. Modi and his BJP party remain extremely popular and are poised to win its third general election.
That report by Samira Hussein in India. The Japanese carmaker Daihatsu says it's suspending operations at all four of its domestic manufacturing plants after a major safety scandal. The company has admitted it's been manipulating the results of safety tests on almost all of its models for 3 decades. The factories in Japan will stop production until at least the end of January, as Mickey Bristow reports.
Earlier this year, Daihatsu admitted that it had manipulated safety tests on a handful of models. Well, last week it revealed that in fact 64 different makes were involved in the falsification of test results, a practice which went back as far as 1989. It seems managers were under pressure to keep production rolling. Investigators have raided the company's offices. Now Daihatsu says it's suspending operations for at least a month at its 4 factories in Japan, which employ 9,000 workers. Thousands of its suppliers could also be hit, and other car firms that depend on parts from Daihatsu. Its parent company, Japan's biggest car manufacturer Toyota, could also suffer damage to its reputation. Daihatsu has been making vehicles for more than a century, churning out nearly 1 million a year in Japan. But now those production lines will fall silent.
Mickey Bristow. Argentina's new president, Javier Milei, has signed a decree cancelling the contracts of 7,000 public sector workers. The people affected were working on one-year renewable contracts that expire at the end of December. Leonardo Rocha reports.
Mr. Milei has also indicated that 45,000 other government workers on long-term contracts may be dismissed. Argentina's opposition and the union say his measures will worsen the crisis and trigger social unrest. They said, ironically, that the latest cuts were Mr. Milei's Christmas present to the country. The measures are part of his efforts to bring down rampant inflation. President Milei's program is centered on cutting government spending, pegging the local currency to the US dollar, and deregulating the economy.
Leonardo Rocha. For a group of prisoners in Chicago, 2024 will bring them fresh hope. They're entering the new year as graduates from one of the highest-ranked universities in the United States, Northwestern. Peter Goffin has been speaking to some of them after they were awarded bachelor's degrees.
I welcome you to the Fellowship of Scholars.
One by one, 16 men were called to the stage inside a former cell house at Stateville Correctional Center. They'd traded in their prison uniforms for scholars' gowns and mortarboards, ready to start the next chapter of their lives as graduates of Northwestern University.
To talk about something being amazing while living in maximum security sounds like a silly statement, but the learning experience, the personal instruction, it's like nothing else.
This is Lynn Green, one of the students speaking from Stateville a few days before the ceremony. He now plans to pursue a master's degree in psychology.
When our instructors come in and they teach us, we realize that we're not so rigid, that we're actually malleable, that we can still be formed and shaped all over again.
Northwestern started its prison education program in 2018. And it's helped dozens of incarcerated people get associate degrees from a nearby community college. But this is the first time that students have received a full bachelor's degree from Northwestern, one of the most prestigious universities in America.
You have read novels, solved math equations, and completed chemistry labs. You have taken courses in psychology, philosophy, and political science.
Sociology professor Mary Patillo gave the ceremony's closing address.
Almost every crime reflects a cycle and often a circle of hurt and harm. Your stories highlight the complexity of what lands people in places like Stateville.
Government figures suggest that 2/3 of Americans released from state prisons will be arrested again, and more than half will return to prison within just a few years. But studies have shown those rates of rearrest and reincarceration are drastically lower for people who've pursued higher education while incarcerated. Bernard McKinley is one of the new graduates. He's also the first person in the state of Illinois ever to take the entrance exam for law school while in prison. And he hopes to one day become a civil rights attorney.
Education creates a way of provoking critical thought. You can't help but do self-analysis unto yourself and see where you were and where you desire to be.
Now, like many of the graduates, he'll stay in the program as a teaching assistant, helping another group of Northwestern students to transform their lives from behind bars.
That report from Peter Goffin. For some, peering into your fridge at this time of year, you may well be faced with a fridge full of Christmas leftovers staring back at you. In many English-speaking countries, this will include turkey, often dry, and unappetizing roast potatoes, which looked so delicious when you sat down for Christmas dinner. So how can you rescue them and reinvigorate your taste buds? Here's cookbook writer Miguel Barclay.
The classic option, the thing that everyone's doing, is the curry. So turkey curry, really easy. Fry up some onions, chuck in everything you've got, a little bit of curry powder, maybe some chopped tomatoes. If you want to go down the sort of chicken tikka masala-y sort of vibe, you can put some ground almond in there or a little splash of cream. If you want to like elevate it a little bit, we're looking at stuff like essentially what you do with a fish cake. So we're going to mash the potato a bit. We're going to get one of those fancy egg rings. We're going to make it 1 inch or 2 inches thick. It's going to be majestic. If you want, you can breadcrumb it. You put a little bit of flour, then a bit of egg, then some breadcrumbs. And then you're going to either pan fry it or put it in the oven. Like that is a centerpiece. You can have it with salad. If you're not really that into the Christmas flavor the day after, go down the Thai fish cake, bind it all together with an egg, put a dollop of some sort of spice mix in there. Get the taste buds revved up. One of the issues with Christmas pudding is that it is not as exciting when it's cold. So something that you could do would be cut a massive slab of it and then pan fry it in butter. And then you get the saltiness of the butter and the richness of the butter. And the diet starts on the 1st of Jan. So you've got this window where you can do whatever you want guilt-free. So take advantage of it and do something that's exciting.
Miguel Barclay. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Danny Cox. Until next time, goodbye. Thank you.